podcast that brings you one guest, one question, one answer. Business insights in minutes, not hours, with your host, the small business and franchise expert, Gary Occhiogrosso.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Mastermind Minutes here on Spotify Radio. My name is Gary Occhiogrosso. I'm the founder and managing partner for Franchise Growth Solutions and the publisher of FranchiseMoneyMaker.com. For those of you who are new to the Mastermind Minutes series, it's a very simple concept. We have one guest, one topic, one answer, and we do it in minutes, not hours. And as we always say, we realize that's a bit of a tease to some folks. So at the end of the program, we will give you the contact information of our guest if you have other questions and would like to know more about what they do. And today I'm honored to have Craig Dunaway, who has been the president of Penn Station East Coast Subs since 1999, which I have to be honest, seems like a lifetime ago for me. Penn Station Subs was founded in Cincinnati back in 1985, and they serve an assortment of fresh grilled and cold deli sandwiches, wraps, salads, and made-to-order products with very high-quality ingredients. Craig formerly also had ownership interest in a Papa John's franchise with a franchisee that owned 11 units. So Craig is no amateur and not new to the franchising business from a lot of different point of views. Penn Station, by the way, has more than 300 locations in 15 states. And Craig, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Well, before we get into the one question, fill in the blanks for us. Tell us a little bit more about how and when and why Penn Station East Coast Subs was founded and really how the brand has grown over the last 35 years. And then we'll get into our question.
Sure. Penn Station was founded, as you indicated, in 1985 in Cincinnati, Ohio, by a gentleman by the name of Jeff Osterfeld. And Jeff came from a family of entrepreneurs. He graduated from Miami University in Oxford in 1982. And when he graduated, he saw his buddies going out into the corporate world and, you know, being transferred all over the country. And because Jeff came from an entrepreneurial family, he thought, you know what, I'm going to do something on my own. And he painted houses during college to help fund college and decided to open a deli. And Jeff opened a deli in Dayton Mall in Dayton, Ohio. And, you know, basically it was Jeffrey's Deli, sold bagels, you know, with various sandwich meats on it. And one of our competitors actually opened up in the mall that sold cheesesteaks. And at the time, Jeff did not even know what a cheesesteak was and, you know, started investigating it, made some trips to Philadelphia to look at the cheesesteaks to see what it was all about. And he thought, you know, this is a really good product. I think I can do this. So that was the genesis of really him starting that. He also went up to the Jersey Shore and looked at, you know, the cold Italian sandwiches and fresh cut fries and fresh squeezed lemonade, and really kind of culminated all that together with a business plan of Penn Station. And the first Penn Station opened in 1985, as you said. And Jeff opened the one in downtown Cincinnati, had a little success with it, enough so that he decided to open a second one. And he opened a second one, and that led to a third. And what Jeff found was that he was just running around between three restaurants. One manager would inevitably quit. He'd have to spend time there. And then the other two would suffer. Mm. So, you know, Jeff at the time started working with our attorneys, who's still with us to this day. And they looked at the franchising model. And really, Jeff had a high regard for McDonald's and Ray Kroc and Wendy's and Dave Thomas. So that's really what started Jeff looking at, simply stated, we need to put an owner as close to the counter as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's what he started doing. He started franchising, had a little bit of success. And I think we're unique in the standpoint that we require franchisees to put their general managers under contract. We believe they're the CEO of their business. And that contract really requires them to be paid a percentage of profits. And then we do a 1,000-point scoring system, a minimum of 6 to 8 times a year at the restaurant. And the managers can earn a significant bonus up to $12,000 a year tied to that performance evaluation bonus. And kind of simply stated, the PE is looking at our standards, our ops manual, and saying these are ideal, and comparing that to a scoring system. And they can earn, again, up to that $12,000. And it makes them focus on the most important things to, you know, to micromanage the business and ultimately be successful.
Yeah. And so, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. So, you know, Jeff started at that. I will tell you that when he first opened, he never looked at how big can I be. He just wanted every restaurant to be successful and profitable for the franchisee. And, you know, when I became a Papa John's franchisee back in 1985, the time Jeff was starting, didn't know him. I lived in Louisville, Kentucky. I remember attending an annual franchise meeting with Papa John's, and John Schnatter said, we're going to be at 2,000 units by the year 2000. And there were probably 150 at the time. But, you know, John had that lofty goal. And, you know, we all know where that stands right now with, you know, more than 5,000 units. And Jeff just wanted them all to be successful. And, you know, we grew much more slowly and methodically in a concentric circle outside of Cincinnati, Ohio. So that's led us to 15 states today. As you indicated, approximately 315 units. We've got approximately 80 franchisees. And we believe that what's best is to grow in a concentric circle outside of Cincinnati. You know, you need brand recognition, people knowing who you are, logistics, which is just simply getting the food there. And you need our oversight. And the further away you get from Cincinnati, one of those three things goes away. It just creates potential problems for the franchisee. And we think ultimately could denigrate the brand.
Well, you've hit upon a couple of things there. I'll tell you, you are preaching to the choir, brother. You know what we do. We take startups and emergings and help them grow. And, you know, the sit down chat that we have to have with the franchisors who are ready to conquer the world, is to grow in concentric circles, to, make sure their franchisees are making money, that they're profitable, that they validate well, to make sure their supply chain makes sense. Don't be hopscotching all over the country. And I think what you said earlier with respect to general managers being tied in an equity position, it really speaks to the culture and the respect for team members, which I also buy into very, very heavily. You know, the other thing you mentioned about, you know, keeping the owner or keeping the franchisee as close to the counter as possible, I think is also very, very important in, you know, in the world of franchising. And I think, just to kind of sum up my takeaway from what you just said, I have this expression, it goes something like, when the mission is more important than the money, success is natural. And it sounds like there was a mission to have successful sandwich shops, putting out good product, putting people in business, helping them be successful, and then teaching them along the way how to become more and more successful. So I think when that's the mission and not just, you know, what's on the P&L, not that that's not important, but when the mission is to help people and really create some level of legacy, I think, as I said, success becomes a natural endeavor at that point.
No, I appreciate that. I think Jeff always looked at it of delayed gratification. And that's very cultural within Penn Station. I mean, you're right. I was in public accounting for 15 years and worked with a lot of different businesses and a lot of different industries. And this is probably the most penny-centric business that I've ever been in. Because if you're putting four slices of tomato, or you're supposed to, if that's the standard on a 6-inch sandwich and you're putting six of them on there, you know, the person who says that's 50% more tomatoes, we're going to lose money. If that's ingrained in them, they can make a lot of money. For the guy who says, what's the big deal? It's only two tomato slices. Well, you know, two tomato slices over 225 sandwiches over 358 days is a lot of tomatoes.
Absolutely. We do an exercise with our startups. If they have $1 million in sales, we show them, hey, look, we're gonna show you how to save 3 points in cost of goods, 2 points in labor. That's 5 points. It's 50 grand to the bottom line. If you don't want it, give it to me. and they're shocked because, you know, it's a half a point here, a point there. It's, you know, it's these little bits and pieces that, you know, really make up the restaurant business. It's very funny for me because people who know me and know I'm in the business, the ones that aren't in the restaurant business, for some reason, there's this thought that restaurateurs have a siphon from the cash register to their pocket. I don't know why, but it's, I think they watch too much Food Network or whatever it is. It's hard work and it requires planning and it requires discipline. And for me, the most important piece is always the people. You've got to have the right people.
I agree. And I think it's important to empower the managers with intimately understanding their profit and loss statement. You know, I've stood in front of 150 to 300 managers at a GM meeting and have said to them, and I said, you know, guys, I'm not trying to lecture you, but if you do not intimately understand how you are paid, you're making a huge mistake. Mm-hmm. Because that's just so important and critical for their bottom line.
Yep.
And I think our franchisees do a very good job at that exercise. And, you know, I didn't create this. I've tried to help, you know, to continue to perfect it over the last 22 years, but it's the culture that Jeff had. It's that top to bottom ownership mentality. And I believe that is what really helped segregate us from our competition during COVID. Mm-hmm. You know, back in March, we didn't know what was going to go on, right? I mean, the country and the world basically came to a stop on March 16th.
Yep.
And what we tried to do was to take all of those important things off the plate of the franchisees so they could run their business, because, you know, some of them were going to run directly into the fire and some of them were going to run away from it. And our job was to try to just give them a calming voice to say, we will help you guys control everything that we can control. And, you know, we actually, ironically, we set up shop, our VP of operations and I set up shop in our conference room and we call it the war zone. And he and I were actually in there for about 7 months working side by side every day. And we filled with a ton of phone calls and just stayed in really, really close contact with our suppliers because we knew we needed to keep our franchisees motivated. They needed to keep their crew motivated and we needed to ensure product continued to flow into their restaurants. Yeah. And, you know, we had a credit card breach back in 2013 at Penn Station. And, you know, at the time, our franchisees were really up in arms about it. How could this happen? And you'll probably recall 30 days later, Target had a credit card breach of about 40 million people. And the, you know, the CFO lost his job over that deal. And my point being that we put out weekly memos to our franchisees. And I told our attorney, I'm going to tell our franchisees what's going on every step of the way, because they've never had this happen before. They're scared to death. And if you don't communicate the important facts, then people are going to just gossip and talk and the rumor mill is going to start. So my point is we did the same thing during COVID. We're continuing to do that to this day. We sent out probably the first 2 months, we sent out a memo every day outlining what was important to them. And then after that, we went every other day and now we're sending it out twice a month. Mm-hmm. And what it's done is it's eliminated phone calls. You know, and we want our franchisees to call us and we encourage them. But if you're telling them everything that's important so that they can anticipate and focus on their business, then they don't have to focus on the superfluous things to take away from them.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, at a very primitive level, what you've done is you've taken away the fear by supplying the information. Yeah. And that's what drives. I mean, fear is a huge motivator. And for folks, you know, I haven't met anyone who, if you really query them about last March 16th and you ask them and assuming they're honest, I think everyone will tell you there was a certain level of fear, not only in every individual, but certainly across the United States. But, you know, that's a good segue into what I want to talk about today, because during COVID, it sounds like you kind of dug in and you got into the fundamentals. We've got to get supply chain. We've got to keep our people motivated. We've got to keep our customers coming in and we've got to do a lot of these things. And it actually sounds like you took a step back, took that mindful breath and kind of created a plan and went forward with it. What I saw, and we did a lot of the same things with our clients, but, and I'm sure you saw the same thing in the industry, we saw a lot of people scrambling for supply chain, hoarding product. If they didn't have third-party ordering platforms, they were signing up with everyone and anyone, creating apps. Apps was a big one, you know, the apps. And that's what I want to talk about today, and spending money and doing all of these things. And maybe you know, leaving some of those other fundamental things on the side, which I personally believe and professionally believe is a mistake. But your company did something different. You kind of gotten away from the whole app scenario. You phased it out while other companies were scrambling around to bring it in. So talk to me about that, because that is definitely counterintuitive to what I saw happening in the world last year during COVID.
Yeah, you know, you're right. It very much is counterintuitive. And I would say that in the industry with other executives that I speak with, they're like, wow, I can't believe you did that. And when I walk them through, you know, your question and I explain to them why we did what we did, I get a lot of head nods and a lot of that makes sense. And, you know, we're selling profitability. I mean, that is what the Penn Station brand sells. It's return on investment. So our primary responsibility is to ensure that we maximize the return on investment for our franchisees. And when we first went into this endeavor with the app, I don't know, we started looking at it 4 years ago, let's say. And, you know, we looked at about 10 different brands that would set up a mobile app. And, you know, we vetted them. I think we really did a nice job in the due diligence process. It's interesting because I had my IT guy go back and look at this about a year before we killed the app. And I think 4 of the 10 companies were no longer in business. Mm. And I think that maybe tells you just a little bit about, you know, the comings and goings of that. It's a very expensive undertaking, obviously.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we first went into this, what we were told is that it would create consumers coming in more. They would come in more often if you had an app and a loyalty component to that app. They would refer their friends. You know, you get the people who are high-end users and they're going to love the brand and everybody's going to stand at the mountaintop and tell everybody they need to try Penn Station. Mm-hmm. And they're going to take the app and they're going to give electronic gift cards to their, you know, their friends, relatives, buddies. So we went into the app with those three thoughts in mind. It would increase frequency and loyalty. They would refer it to their friends and, you know, we would give them points in return. And when we signed up for this, we were finding within the system between what we were paying for monthly administration of the product, because you have to keep it current. I mean, I don't know what iPhone that you have sitting on before you right now. It's probably an iPhone 11. Well, what if you have an iPhone 8? That technology isn't necessarily keeping up with the ads. So it was a situation where we felt like we were always having to pay for upgrades, not because of our technology and efficiency, but because of the technology and efficiency of a consumer. Because every consumer has a different model of cell phone or Samsung. Mm-hmm. And so we were spending about $350,000 a year collectively between our franchisees, what they were paying on a monthly basis, and what the system was paying from an administrative standpoint. And when I step back and look at this from 30,000 feet, we had approximately 1.2 million customers who signed up originally for the app, and 600,000 of them never used it once. Mm. They signed up and they just stopped. And ultimately what we found is there were only about 13 or 14% who actually used it. And when we took a look at the usage of those, it was about 80% who only used it about once every 6 months. And so what initially drove this, it was lack of usage and it was the expense. But I think one thing that we've built over a 20-year period is we have a very loyal customer base. And they are very willing to communicate with Penn Station because we want to be very much out front, open with them. If you have a question, we'll answer it candidly. And we have an email program with about 900,000 customers in this database. And they are actively engaged. So we felt like we had another tool to reach out to them. And when we studied, you know, Gary, when we study the top 10 apps in the country, what we find is 4 of the top 10 with respect to the restaurant industry are third-party delivery companies. You know, people don't want to necessarily sign up for Penn Station or insert brand. You know, they sign up for the big brand. Starbucks is phenomenal at it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people drink Starbucks 4, 5, 6 days a week. I know Chipotle has a big one. And you know, the company we worked with on this ultimately agreed that it is huge data mining.
I mean, it is just, you can, the amount of information that you can gather, if you have a team of analysts to study that, is profound. I've got one finance guy and I've got one IT guy, and they're not going to spend all their time mining a small percentage of information from a small percentage of customers who even signed up for the app.
Absolutely. You know, I tell folks all the time, people say knowledge is power. I say, well, actually, I don't mean to correct you. Knowledge in and of itself is not power. The execution of the knowledge is power. Right. And if you can't do anything with all this information, what good is it?
Well, and you know, when we did the app, the other thing that we looked at was, and we were tying it in with our setting up our online ordering process. So we had, you could order online through your computer, through your phone, or you could do it through the app. Well, look at the, I talked about back from 2013 when Penn Station had a credit card breach. You and I know how reticent consumers are to want to give up their credit card information. So that means if they were to order through the app, they didn't want to give us the credit card information. And further, 80% of the orders never went through the app. They would just log on to their mobile phone, go to our Penn Station website, and completely bypass the app totally.
Yeah.
And so we looked at the points that were being, you know, you spend a dollar, you get a point. That's pretty simple, you know, one-on-one. And when we took a look at the number of points that had been accumulated by consumers, and we looked at this logically, it was like, if we kill this, we are, frankly, we're just not going to upset that many people. Mm-hmm. We think we can kill it. We can give everybody who complains a free meal. And we think we can save $350,000 a year. And we believe that we will create as much efficiency through ordering online that we can with the app. And it's interesting because we actually track, I wrote a letter to go to any consumer who complained through our email program of, why'd you kill the app? I had 150 points, you know, I'm going to lose out. And so if you had 100 points or less, I would give you a free meal. And if you had more than 100, I would give you two free meals. Since we killed the app, we have only given away less than 200 subs to consumers who have complained, and only 95 consumers have complained.
Wow.
And so the last one complained just yesterday. That means that I killed something that I told consumers about November 1st. We're killing the app. You can continue to earn points through December 1st. And after December 1st through 12/31, you're not going to get any points, and then the app goes away. And I had a complaint yesterday that, what happened to my points? That's been 4.5 months. Right. So most consumers, I think, they don't want to pull their phone out to do this through the app. Yeah. And that was our logic behind it.
I agree. I know that there are some companies that are big on it, and I'm sure it works well for them, and obviously for you. And being a former accountant, I mean, we're not gonna debate the numbers. Sounds like you did the analysis and the cost benefit on it, and there really wasn't much of a cost benefit. So it makes perfectly good sense. Do you know of any other quick service or fast casual chain that got rid of their app? Did you research this in terms of what you, that might have helped you predict the impact of this?
Well, I would say we did a lot of research, but can I pull out the 4-page report that we did for that research? No. What we did, and I asked all my friends, I asked many, many business associates, tell me what food apps you have on your cell phone. And the answer was always maybe one third-party delivery company and Starbucks. And what about food brands? No. Chipotle, I mean, they're a huge company, obviously publicly held. Chipotle, I think, has a very good app, but they also have, again, that team behind them who can study that, you know, that demographic information.
Yeah.
When we talked to franchisees about it, they complained about the ancillary things that you wouldn't think about. You know, you have to have a scanner in the restaurant. Well, scanner's $150. What happens when a consumer knocks it off and it breaks? You go spend another $150, right? And so all these little things came into it that I think were additional hidden costs that we hadn't factored. And when I talked to consumers about it, even the most loyal were like, I'll still come in. I like to get the points, but it's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
And we kept asking, why do we need it? There was never a good answer other than, well, everybody has an app.
Right.
Well, you know, it's, everybody jumps off the bridge. We're not jumping.
Right. I hear you. And I have to admit, I did download the Chipotle app, and I'll tell you why. Because so many people in the industry and even consumers, friends, and by the way, I love your survey with other business people and friends and family, because that's where you get like the real information.
Right.
But so many people had told me how amazing this app was that I downloaded it essentially just to play with it. I wanted to see what it did and all this other stuff. I never used it. I mean, I got rid of it. It was just taking up space on my phone. And I know other people who downloaded it, and I'm not picking on Chipotle, by the way, but they downloaded it just to kind of look at it and see what it did, but wasn't anything that they were using. So it's interesting. This is, to me, very interesting information in the industry and for folks who tune into this program that like to hear these little tidbits of things that are going on that sometimes are, you know, the zag when the whole world is zigging, to me makes it very, very interesting. If someone wants to get in touch with you or get in touch with, they want to know more about Penn Station subs or maybe even become a franchisee or whatever, how do they reach out to you?
Sure, happy to give up that information. They can visit penn-station.com, PENN-station.com. Visit our website and learn more about the brand. If they want to make a call to the office, they can call 513-474-5957. Happy to, you know, put anyone who wants to discuss Penn Station more in touch with the right person. Or they can email me directly. My email is CND, as in Craig Nancy David, at penn-station.com.
Simple enough. And we will put all of that into the podcast. Craig, any last word, any last thought you want to give us either on the use of apps or Penn Station in general?
I will say one other thing with the app that I think is important if someone's considering it is it felt like us that it was a form of electronic discount. You know, we were giving something to consumers who by and large were going to get it anyway. We're selling a premium product, and I think people are willing to pay for that. And so it ran a little incongruent with our philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I think the lack of usage by those consumers and the number of people who signed up only for the free sub to never use it again kind of supports the point that I just made.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, fascinating topic. Pleasure meeting you here via this program. And I look forward to seeing you at some of the IFA events or some of the other franchise events and restaurant events around the country. And I want to thank you very much for your time today. Truly appreciate it.
Gary, likewise. Thanks so much. Good to meet you.